Welcome to the Distance to Empty podcast, the podcast where we chatter on and on about 200 plus mile ultramarathons, multi-day races, and events. I'm your host, Kevin Goldberg, and I'm here with my co-host, Peter Noyes. Peter, you're running again.
I am running. I am running 2 miles at a time, and so far it feels okay, other than that my heart rate is that of a hummingbird.
Hey, hummingbirds have excellent endurance, so that's maybe that's just how you are now. Awesome to see. Really, really cool to see you back getting after it.
Thank you. How are you doing?
I'm good. I am enjoying my first rest day here in like almost 3 weeks, which is very long for me. I like rest days. I take them just about every week. So long stretch for me. Cannot believe that Cocodona is like 8 weeks out from the time from the release of this episode. So it is really coming up quick. I'm feeling very ready and I'm excited. I have a down week next week and then like a really big 3 or 4 week block, probably the biggest block I've ever done. So I'm looking forward to continuing the training and hopefully arriving at the start line in one piece.
Awesome. Can't wait to follow.
So today's guest, I'm pretty excited to chat with this guy. This person actually reached out to us on Instagram just to tell us how much they were liking the podcast and introduce themselves. And kind of ironically, a couple of weeks after that, we actually met in person at an event at the Seguro Showdown Backyard Ultra. Turns out that this guy has, you know, big goals about surrounding qualifying for Big's Backyard. He's got a couple of FKT projects he's working on. And last year he ran the Triple Crown of 200. So I wanted to have him on the podcast to really dive into the Triple Crown, talk about what it is, get into each individual race, you know, talk about what makes those races unique and really kind of dive into those destination trail Triple Crown races. So yeah, let's get to it with Jameson Collins. Here we go. Jameson, welcome to Distance to Empty. Thanks for being here, man.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys. Good to sit down and chat with you.
Yeah, we're stoked to dive into the Triple Crown and really break things down today. So can you introduce yourself to our listeners? Tell us a little about yourself, sort of how you came to the sport. And I think you went from 50K to 240 miles off the bat there. So explain to us where your lapse in judgment came there.
Yeah, totally. It's all West Plate's fault. Well, I'll get there, though. So I ran, I was like not, just a real quick background on myself, like I was a pretty terrible runner. I used to have to run during work. I was a firefighter with the U.S. Forest Service and they'd make us PT and I absolutely hated running for years. And then I kind of got into it when I moved up to Alaska and started trail running finally and like got off the pavement a little bit and started having these cool experiences out in the woods. And I was going through transition into sobriety at the time. This was in like 2021. And so it just kind of became a good practice for me to have in my life. And I ran a marathon and that was pretty cool. But during that process, I was like, I started to like kind of get into the idea of, I was watching these people do ultras on YouTube and stuff. And I was like wildly fascinated. I read this book and this book was like, you can run ultras. And I was like, no, I can't. But I decided to sign up. I put my name jokingly in a lottery for a 50K and got drawn. And so I was like, okay, well, I guess I got to do that. And then that race got canceled. So I just did like a self, I just went out and ran a 50K on that weekend instead and absolutely hated it. And it destroyed me. I got home and I was sitting on the couch in Alaska in the middle of the winter. It was like January. And the lottery for the open period for Moab 240 was open. And it was actually Cocodona is what got me into these things because I actually worked in Prescott for a couple years fighting fire, like back in like 2005, six, kind of seven. And so like the whole Cocodona course, like I've flown all over it in a helicopter. Like I've been all over in the Bradshaws and like just all around up and around the Coconino Plateau, Flagstaff and stuff. And so I was like checking out Cocodona and I was like, well, I got to do this, but the timing wasn't right. And then I found out that the Moab thing was open and I just kind of jokingly put my name in there sitting on the couch banged up from a 50K. And then I got drawn and I was like, well, I can't do that. You know, like I can't run a 200 miler and I didn't even know what that was really like, but I can't, certainly can't do that in like, you know, 10 months. But then I did. And I kind of at the time was experimenting with like trying to figure out who I was after like drinking for my entire adult life. And I was kind of trying to push the limits and find out who I really was and like kind of challenge some of the negative self-talk that I've been kind of working with my whole life. And I didn't actually think I was going to like do it or be able to finish or anything like that. I just kind of went for it, hoping to learn a lot. And I certainly did, but I made it to the finish line too. And that was like a pretty significant milestone in my life for sure. You know, I don't really recommend going from a 50K to a 240 miler between January and October, but time and time again, people have proved that it's totally possible, myself included. And I'll tell anybody that, like, yeah, sign up and you'll figure it out.
Yeah. So did you have any races between the 50K and Moab? Or?
I did. Yeah. So I met up with a guy who had done a couple hundred milers at like a local run club up in Alaska. And I started training with him and his wife, and they kind of like tutored me. They took me under their wing and started getting me out in big days in the mountains. So I did like another like self-supported 40 miler, and I did a backyard that summer, and I ran like 58 miles, which was like by far my longest run. And when I finished that, I was like absolutely certain I couldn't run 240 miles, right? I was just like, oh no, I'm in trouble. And then like that same guy talked me into running a 50 miler, like a mountain 50 miler 2 weeks after that backyard. And then that was pretty much it for racing. And then I just used the rest of that summer, fall. We transitioned back to the lower 48 at that time. And so I got down here and started running around in Oregon up in the mountains and stuff and trying to figure it out for myself. You know, I don't think I focused on the right things, but I needed to do Moab to learn that.
And then, so you did Moab, and it's crazy that you went into that like not thinking you could finish. Cause that's, I mean, most people who do that, I think, don't finish, right? Like like when I run 200s, like I think the why is it's magnified the further you go, right? So like anyone can get through a 50K if they, you know, train reasonably well, but like the higher up in distance you go, the more the why matters. And like, if you don't have a strong why or don't believe in yourself, like chances are you're going to fail. So did you find that along the way, like during that race, or did you just all of a sudden stumble through the finish line and be like, oh, here I am?
No, it's actually, I'm really lucky the way it worked out. The guy that I met in Alaska, here's the other interesting part of this is the guy I met in Alaska that had ran some 100 miles that I trained with. We connected because he was like, oh, I'm running this big race in Moab called the Moab 240 this fall. And I was like, oh, me too. So we actually like kind of trained together, and we knew we were doing it together. And we were like, we're going to run together for as long as it makes sense. That was our plan going into it. But I basically like, I had some serious issues at Moab in 2022, the first one. Like I wore Crocs around Moab. I got there early to like hang out in the desert and acclimate. And what I actually acclimated was like, I hung out with no shoes on for like a week and my feet totally dried out. And then I basically had blisters when I got to Hidden Valley, like the 8 mile aid station already. And like my feet just totally fell apart and everything else fell apart. So I was ready to quit like at the 100K mark, like coming into Indian Creek, like, but I was running with my buddy and I like didn't want to let him down. And so I just kind of like kept getting up and leaving aid stations with him. Like, I don't want to do this anymore and I'm probably not going to finish, but like, I'm not ready to let you down yet kind of thing, you know? And then we just did that for like 5 days. and then we were back in Moab and it was fine. We got belt buckled.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, hey, that's one way to do it. And then, you know, now you have the confidence, now you believe in yourself. You're all right, I did this. And that's, I mean, speak to, before we dive into like, you know, breaking down the Triple Crown itself, like what led you to signing up for the Triple Crown the following year? And like, how does your mindset change from, oh, I'm putting my name into this race that I don't think I'll get into, and if I do get into it, I don't think I'll finish, to I'm signing up for all three?
Yeah. Yeah. So it was like the kind of the beginning of it, the like, cause you guys know how it is. Like, you have these crazy moments of clarity when you're out doing it, especially in the longer stuff, like the multi-day stuff. You have these like moments where your whole life becomes like crystal clear and you can see it all and it all makes sense and stuff. Right. You know, and then you can never remember that like afterwards, but I did have this moment. We had picked up a guy. We were headed up the Shea Mountain climb, and we picked up this dude from Canada. And this dude, Ken, he was super rad, and we ran with him for a while. And I was just like intrigued by all this. So the year I did it was the year that West Plate did the Grand Slam and like documented all those sweet videos. And so I had been following that and like I was actually running that race with them. It was super cool to me. So I was just like intrigued by the Triple Crown already, still like not on my radar, but I asked Ken about it on that climb. I was like, what do you think of the Triple Crown? And he was like, I think it's super awesome. But like at this point in my life, I'm like 56 and I have four kids and like, I just like, I could never commit a whole summer to this, you know? And like that really stuck with me. And I was just like, I remember finishing that race and I was like, I got to do this now because I might not ever have the opportunity to do it again. And that was, I think, kind of planted the seed for the Triple Crown. And then really it was like, I really wanted to do Tahoe. After doing Moab and getting to the finish line, I was like, oh, I could do these things. So I could actually like sign up for another one. That's, you know, like, and I really wanted to do Tahoe. And because I'm from Northern California and I love the Sierras. And I had talked to this lady during Moab that was like, she's like, crewing Tahoe is deluxe. Like the runners come down to the road and you just sit and wait for them and then they leave. And like, it's not like crewing Moab or Bigfoot. Like, and so I told my wife that and she's like, well, I want to crew Tahoe because she just had this terrible experience at Moab. And I was like, well, the only way to do Tahoe at this point is to do the Triple Crown. And so those two things in conjunction, I basically like emailed Garrett on the way home, emailed Destination Trails on the way home from Moab, like without any skin on my feet. And I was like, I want to do the Triple Crown. and that was it. Yeah. Started planning from there.
That's a pretty fun adventure to get into this. It seems like you accidentally stumbled into doing all the right things, like finding a community of support and, you know, setting intermediate goals to build up to that first Moab. So
totally.
Yeah, I think whether you knew it or not, it seemed like you're doing all the right things.
Yeah, that's how I feel for sure. It's like it all just kind of like accidentally happened and I'm really happy where it ended up. And I'm really happy with where it's all taken me to this point, you know?
Yeah, so maybe diving into the Triple Crown, you started off with Tahoe saying that that's really what drew you to the Triple Crown was Tahoe in particular and the ease of crewing and whatnot. I guess, how did that actually play out? Was it actually easy to crew or talk to us about Tahoe.
Yeah, no, it was actually like, it was easy for me because I just had to get to the aid stations. It was pretty hard for the crew because Tahoe in July, it ended up being in July and it's probably not much different in June, but it's so busy. And so it was just really challenging. You know, it seemed straightforward to drive over here and drive over there, but it was like parking was really limited and they kind of switched up the way they're doing business with crew vehicles at aid stations. Yeah, it ended up, ironically, it was like my least favorite of all three of them, racing, and it was like one of the more difficult ones to crew.
Yeah, I think I've crewed Tahoe as well. And I do remember like just sitting in like lines of traffic trying to get from one little lake town to the next. And like, you know, you're only going 6 miles, but it might take you, you know, 40 minutes. So that was frustrating. So Tahoe in 2023 was the snow adjusted year. So it was moved from June to July. So it was a little warmer, less snow on the course. What were like, tell us about the course. What were you most looking forward to? What lived up to the hype? What maybe didn't? And you know, you said it was your least favorite of the three. So kind of just walk us through like, what made you want to run Tahoe and then what met those expectations and what maybe fell short and like just give us your whole vibe of the race itself.
Yeah. Yeah. So first of all, like when I say it was my least favorite, it was still a super awesome race. Like don't mistake that. Like, I had a great time. It was my least favorite in the way that like, I think we talked about this at Saguaro, Kev, is like, you spend like 3 days on these beautiful mountaintops looking down at the most beautiful lake in the world and you can't get in it. I was just like, I want to go get in that lake. Like, what am I doing up here? I just wanted to be done the whole time. And, you know, and it was like, it was a lot hotter than expected. And it was pretty rough. Like that first day took a toll on the field for sure. And I like barely made it out of that alive. And so it was just, I was like behind on everything. Everybody was just like, everybody that got through the first day had a really hard time continuing on for the next 2 to 4 days, however long it took. But it was really that snow adjustment and combined with like an epic heat wave. I remember It was like almost in the 90s at like 8,000 feet on the first day coming up over Armstrong Pass. Like, and people were just like croaking. Like, I had some, I kind of forgot to like bring electrolytes with me. I didn't know what I was doing still, you know. But I didn't bring any Tailwind or anything with me or any salt tabs. And I got cooked and I got to the point where like I couldn't drink any more water because it was just like disgusting. And I remember getting to the aid station down at Housewife Hill. The folks that run this year in 24 will go to the same aid station. It's like the 100K turnaround point or the 50K turnaround point back to Heavenly. And I got down there and like it was like a war zone. There was just like people laying around barfing all over on each other and like all these aid station volunteers were like trying to get people food and like water. And there was just so much barf. Like it was nuts. And I was just like, oh boy, like, I guess I'm doing all right. I need to get out of here. Like, but I've never seen such a like chaos aid station in my life, at any race. And it was just like, the heat just like smoked people that day. And then it kept getting hot. So like, you know, the second day it got hot again, the third day it got hot again. So it was like, that was really the challenge, is being up high exposed with like a lot of sun and heat.
Yeah. If people aren't used to the altitude, like, you know, I live at 5,600 feet and do a lot of my training well above that. And it's like, you know, 70 degrees can be unbearably hot, let alone 80 and 90. Like it changes, you know, it's different from sea level heat for sure.
Absolutely. Yeah. That was my big, like, learning lesson as I trained. I tried to get up in the mountains, but for the most part, my training going into Tahoe is like done at sea level. I live in Willamette Valley, Oregon. Like, and so although I had done some heat training, I hadn't done high and hot. And I think that was a lot of people, you know, it's way different. Those two things combined are really challenging if you're not prepared for them.
Yeah. I've been through two altitude races with heat and it's never fun. So what did your heat acclimation look like ahead of Tahoe?
Ahead of Tahoe. I mean, I was like, we were having a pretty warm spring in Oregon and I would purposefully wait for it to get warm to go run. So I'd like go run out in the sun during the heat of the day, that kind of stuff. And then, like I said, though, it was still pretty cool. We didn't really have much access because we had a ton of snow in Oregon that spring as well. So like the Cascades were still fairly off limits going into Tahoe. So it was mostly for me, it was lower elevation running. And I didn't do any like, you know, any like protocols. Like I didn't do any sauna training or anything like that. I was pretty still element. Like I had just hired a coach going into Tahoe and I was just like, you know, I almost went into Tahoe just like trying to figure it out on my own. And I'm glad I didn't. So
yeah. Yeah, I've done like heat protocol for all of my Cocodonas, like sauna, you know, I don't do it year round, but you know, it's an acute adaptation. So like, obviously there's health benefits for year round use as well. But if you're looking for like the actual, you know, benefit for a specific event, like it's just a 2 to 4 week kind of cycle. And I do that each year for Cocodona and I think it helps, but you know.
Yeah.
So, you know, so you're doing your training more out of the mountains than in the mountains leading up for Tahoe and like, we can get into what your training looked like kind of in between the races, but leading up to Tahoe, it being the first one, like what did training look like overall volume? And like, was the anticipation that you weren't going to be able to train much in between the races? Like was, you know, were you training for Tahoe and then kind of planning to ride that training through it? And, you know,
Yeah, exactly. Like we knew that the turnaround from Tahoe into Bigfoot was going to be short. And we knew we weren't going to have like a whole lot of running in between the races. So it was like big build, no real races going into the Triple Crown, just like a big build, focusing on getting the volume up, really low intensity. Like we didn't do much of anything besides like slow running, big back-to-back days, lots of vert, just spending time in typical terrain was the big focus, you know? So like, when I went into my, like when I hired a coach and got started with him and he started to tweak things, I had been doing like two big back-to-back days each weekend and he left those alone. And those were just really slow, easy days where I'd go out and do 20 miles in like 5 or 6 or 7 hours, just depending on where I was at, but just like slow cruising. And I did, you know, got up to probably, we were doing hours, but I think I was probably doing about like 70 miles a week or something going into it, which was a lot for me, like still pretty new, you know, to ultra running. But we really took the time to focus on like practicing stuff that happens during a 200 miler. And my coach is really big on that. Like we did a lot of like aid station transition stuff. I did do one like tune-up run that was a 24-hour race that spring. That was like a fun adventure quest race. But it was basically like a run all night with a chance to like practice asleep in the middle of it. So we like ran all day and then I went to bed for like 2 hours like you would in a 200 or like a couple hours, you know, get in, eat, do your thing, get set up, go to sleep, wake up and get moving again. Spent a lot of time practicing those little things and figuring out like how I wanted aid stations to look, how I wanted to, you know, my gear to look, doing just really working on the stuff that people probably don't spend, especially inexperienced people like myself at the time, like don't spend enough. They think like, oh, I just got to go run a ton. But it's like for a 200, I think it's actually about like, yeah, learning how to take care of yourself out there for several days, you know, that's the thing I harp on the most. And so that was kind of what the training went into it. You know, a lot of slow running, being outside, enjoying, you know, moving slow for a long time and then like practicing eating a lot of food and going for a run and stuff like that, you know?
Yeah, I think a lot of the value in a good 200 coach is them bringing, you know, all that logistics
for sure,
help and training. It's not just programming the workouts.
Yeah.
So before we switch gears to the next race, any memorable moments from Tahoe?
Yeah, for sure. So there's like, I'll try to be quick about this so we can move through this, but like, I really got into this stuff to like learn about myself and push myself and like kind of become a different person because I wasn't really happy with who I was at the time. And like, I didn't believe, like you said, Kev, I didn't believe that I could like do Moab when I started it. And then I proved myself wrong and it was really surprising. And I was like, well, okay, like if I can do that, what else can I do? And so when I went into the Triple Crown, after I had signed up and I started thinking about it, I was like, well, I know I can do a 200 miler. Like, let's turn the screws on this and like up the stakes a little bit. I'm going to actually try to do good. So like kind of just as another joke, I was like, what does top 10 at Tahoe look like? You know? And it was like in the low 70s. And I was like, well, it took me 112 hours to do Moab. I could probably do Tahoe in like 72 hours, you know? Sure. That's the goal, right? I'll set that goal and give it a shot and see what happens. So to get to your question, like that was our plan. And everybody understood it. And I was hanging in there. I was like, you know, top 10 basically from the turnaround at Tahoe City coming back towards the finish line. And I wanted to maintain that. And I had a pretty rough patch in there somewhere. Like I almost just gave up on that whole goal because it wasn't fun anymore. And I tried to like kind of give up on that actually. And my pacer TR, the guy who I ran Moab with, was like, that's not what you came here for. He kind of like did the awesome, like checked me. And he's like, nope, you don't get to give up yet. You can give up after we finish this thing, but like you're in it, you need to go. And so I stuck with it and I had like 20 miles up over the second to last mountain where I just couldn't stay awake. I was just having the like zombie walk, like sleep hallucination fest, and I was in Lord of the Rings and like I couldn't figure it out. And then I was leaving the next aid station and Sally McCray, who was running the Triple Crown this year, she like started to make a move late in the race. And at Tahoe you can like check the tracker the whole time because you have cell service. And I was like, oh man, Sally's coming. Like she is coming down the mountain behind me and like she's an elite athlete and I'm just like some nobody and she's like definitely gonna pass me. And that would put me in 11th. So I need to go catch somebody. That was my mindset leaving this aid station. And something about that, and this is the first time I've ever realized I was like a competitive person, is I left Spooner Summit headed back towards Heavenly. It's like an 18-mile stretch. And I remember I crossed the 200-mile mark and looked at my watch, and I just ran like an 11-minute mile uphill, running from Sally McCray trying to catch Elsa Jaworski, who was out in front of me. And I like smashed up this mountain and I like, we got to the top at like right at sunrise at like 6 a.m. above Lake Tahoe in the most beautiful place ever. And I was just like on the sickest high. And I was like, okay, here we go. Like I got to run to the finish line. And this is 200 miles in at this point. And I almost dropped my pacer. Like I just went on one. And I was like, I didn't even know, like, I don't know. I didn't know you could do that. I didn't think you could do that at the end of a 200 miler. Like those were my best miles of the entire race, the last 18 to the finish line. Yeah. And I ended up getting ninth overall. I almost caught the guy in front of me. Like, and I just remember crossing the finish line and being like, oh, I don't know anything. Everything I thought about myself and humans and what we're capable and all of that is like totally wrong. Like there's magical powers out there that like, you know, I need to continue to explore this. And that was my lesson, is that like competitiveness, like competing, other people can give you powers that you didn't know existed within you. And that's a super cool thing to experience. So that was like, yeah, that was the last 18 miles of Tahoe. And then I was like, okay, well, like, let's keep going with that. We got the rest of the Triple Crown to like play with this stuff. So that was really, it was a really cool experience to have at the beginning of the summer.
Yeah, that's a really cool, like, eye-opening experience. I've definitely experienced similar, like, you know, like you said, the power of like, you know, what other people can bring out of you. And like, yeah, just, you know, if you've told me at a certain point in the race, if you told me at mile 140 that I was going to be doing 9 minute miles down Eldon at Cocodona at the end, I would have told you, like, you know, it's more likely that a polar bear is going to come out and eat me. Like, so it's wild what we're capable of. And it, you know, when the ability strikes, you just got to take advantage of it. So cool. Tahoe 200 in the books, shifting over to Bigfoot 200, which in 2023 had the unique challenge of only having 16, 17 days in between. So, you know, formerly the Triple Crown was about three and a half weeks in between each race. Last 2 years, it's been about 2.5, 3 months between each race. But that wasn't the case because Tahoe got moved, you know, just 17 days before Bigfoot. So, what did, before we dive into Bigfoot, what did those 17 days look like between Tahoe and Bigfoot?
Yeah. So it, to this day, after like a long, anything like over 100 miles, it takes me about a month to be like feeling really good again. And so kind of knowing, kind of assuming that like I wasn't going to be great, and we were just going to focus on recovery. That was the plan. Right. And, I think I ran once in between Tahoe and Bigfoot. I like went on a jog to prove to, my coach was like, just go like jog for 4 miles so that you know that you still know how. And I did that, but it was mostly just like getting back into a good sleep routine and eating really well and just like really taking care of myself. That was the main focus. We knew that we were going to get the most bang for our buck, just like not being physical and just like letting ourselves heal and recover as much as possible. Counterintuitive, and it was really hard to do, like, but you know, I think it worked out in the long run.
So knowing that, you know, you had this competitive drive coming off of Tahoe, 17 days mostly down, like what was your strategy going into Bigfoot? Like how did you kind of balance, you know, trying to be competitive but also knowing you have a whole summer of races and had limited, you know, rest, you know, after the last race?
Yeah, honestly, like I didn't think it was going to be as big of a deal as it was. I was like, well, I'm just going to go out and I think I can do this in 75 hours. And on paper, if you look at historically, that's like a pretty solid top 10 finish, you know, and that's what I was shooting for. Just kind of like, you know, a little bit better in the top 10. But that, I had a time goal that I was after and I was pretty confident I could do that. And what I didn't realize is that like the rest, there was a bunch of people at that race that didn't do Tahoe 17 days ago. And I couldn't compete with those people. I did finish like right around my time. You know, I did almost hit my time goal. It was just a faster year, but it was same strategy, just like continue focusing on, like I learned that I was capable of things I didn't think. So it was like, I knew like when I get into day three and I think I just need to like do my best, like try to keep exploring that place where like, what, how do I harness that again? And I was able to do a little bit of that, but I had sleep issues at Bigfoot, which I think a lot of people do, you know, it's a different course. It's then, you know, it's like, it's a gnarly mountain hike run in Washington, and it's like, it's hard to hit the sleep right there. And it's very easy. I would say it's very easy to get, because you're not running as much, it's really easy to get stuck between aid stations in a bad spot where you're tired or you haven't done the right thing at the last aid station. And you just can like zombie walk for like 6 hours and not get to the next aid station. You're just like, don't even know where you are. That happened to me. Like I lost my mind in Quartz Creek, headed up out of there. That's like that big, like 7,000 foot section. Like I fell apart. I was trying to sleep out there and I couldn't, you know, and it was just like, I finally got, I think it took us eight, that section took me like 8 hours to do like 18 miles.
Yeah. Bigfoot is notorious for that. I've run Bigfoot 3 times and it was interesting watching the race last year. The times were quite faster. I heard from friends who have run it in the past that it was the, and maybe it'll be surprising to you because I bet it didn't feel this way, but it was the best condition the course has ever been in.
Yeah.
That they actually did a lot of trail work and removed a lot of blowdowns, and like that the trail was a little more of a trail, because, you know, the years I've run it, it seems like you're the only person who uses that trail every August. Like that's it.
Yeah, no, I was like actually pleasantly surprised based on everything I had heard about the course. Like the motorcycle ruts weren't as bad. The blowdowns weren't as bad. The like green tunnel at the end coming down off the mountain wasn't as bad. Like it was pretty nice, really, you know, it's good trails and good support.
I'll have to go back. It sounds lovely. Sounds lovely. do you still think it lives up to its reputation? Would you say you thought it was the hardest of the three?
I think it depends on your goal, but I think for most people, like if you were to just compare them side by side by side, I would say that Bigfoot is the most difficult one. Yeah, I think so. It's definitely the one I want another shot at the most, because I don't feel like I raised my potential there, you know? And I bet a lot of people have that experience. Like you get through it, you suffered and you're like, oh man, I could do better. Like,
so you thinking of going back just to do that one?
No, I'm going to run the Triple Crown again next year. Cat's out of the bag.
Nice. Yeah. Yeah. Bigfoot's definitely my favorite of three. Something about that part of the Pacific Northwest. I mean, you know, you're in Oregon, you get it. It's
oh, yeah.
Maybe not the same as up north there, but it's close. I just, you know, some people I've heard like say they don't like the green tunnel, but I love the green tunnel. Like I like sock me in between the pines and let me just kind of stroll and I'm happy. So it's a really pretty race, and it's definitely, to your point, like difficult to sleep, difficult to get comfortable at, difficult to do everything at, but that's what makes it awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Yeah. It's a different kind of adventure for sure.
Yeah. Bigfoot's on my list too. I'm in Southern California, so I see a lot of desert. Most of the races I've done have been more desert. So
yeah.
I really want to see a race in the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah. That's a good one.
All right. So you make it through Bigfoot. I bet that feels like just a whirlwind, you know, in less than 3 weeks time, you've run 200 milers, but now you have, almost, 2 full months, till Moab 240. So what did your time in between, Bigfoot and Moab look like? And how did your previous experience at Moab affect your approach to it this time? Like, was there more fear and anxiety knowing what was to come, or was it more comfort and like experience that was like, all right, this is what I'm going to do because I learned this last time?
Yeah, no, actually, so I'll answer that part first. I was terrified to go back to Moab. I actually didn't want to go back to Moab. Like, it was just like the side effect of doing the Triple Crown. I was like, okay, I really just wanted to, you know, do the other two. But it was like, after what I went through the year before at Moab, I was just like, I don't ever want to see my feet like that again. I don't ever want to feel like that again. Like, I was not looking forward to it. But my coach was like, well, you're a different person now. And so we can expect a different experience. And so he kind of got me like, bought into it a little bit. The interesting thing was, is I think the like Tahoe, Bigfoot, quick turnaround, like the main effect from that actually came after Bigfoot. Like that's where it really set in, not before, but like when I finished Bigfoot, I was like the week after that, like I was just like, I couldn't sleep at night. I would just lay in bed and sweat all over myself. Like I couldn't eat. I couldn't sleep. Like that was when it really hit me. it like compounded on itself. And since we had more time, like you said, took it really easy, got that stuff sorted out. And that took about 2 weeks to where I was like even comfortable, like wanting to go for a walk, really, you know. It was like, I had to go back to work. I was doing construction at the time. So that was about all I could handle, was like trying to suffer through a day of work. And then once we started moving again, though, it was like, okay, we actually got a little bit of time and something to work with. And we kind of, we went into Moab. The plan was to like, let's actually do like a little bit, since we're not going to like, we don't need to do a bunch of volume right now. Like we pretty much got that covered. Like let's do some kind of intentional like fitness work in this little period we have between. And that got really fun. Like I have never, probably because I'm so new to running, like I've never been in a position where I had this huge base to work with and could just like achieve so much fitness in a short amount of time. Like, and so that was really fun for me. We started doing, once I could run again, we started doing some like faster workouts and so, you know, it's like all that kind of stuff, but on a condensed schedule. But it was just like, every time I ran, my like easy pace was better next time, you know? And it was just like, the fitness just kept coming, going into Moab. And so I actually like, you know, cause Jet, my coach was like, you're going to run a lot more at Moab. And that's like your weak spot. Like I'm actually comfortable in the mountains hiking around Bigfoot, but like running for days and days and days, that's like, that was my weakness, is like. And so he's like, you're going to run a lot. Let's focus on that. And let's try to get you just a little bit more fit. So all those like flatter miles at Moab are easier. And once I started seeing that happen, I got like really excited about Moab. And I was like, okay, I'm going to try to end up on the podium of this thing. You know, I'm just going to like go run as hard as I can for 3 days and see what happens. It went pretty good, you know, but that's what it looked like. It was just like a good recovery period and then just like fitness work. And I thought that was a cool approach. Like I'd recommend that for people that do the triple crown, is like, you don't have to do much volume in between the races, but you can, if you have a normal, like 2 month period, you can do like a little mini build in there where you like work on run a little bit faster and get your fitness up. And like, you'll see, I think most people see good results doing that, you know?
Yeah. And I think you can impact speed quicker than you can impact like there's not really time to get significant volume in where it would be beneficial. It would just be detrimental, but you know, by trying to get a little quicker, you can do more in less time. And at, like you said, at Moab, like, I mean, I struggle with the same thing at Cocodona. Like I would much prefer to like go play in the mountains and hike all day.
Yeah.
And Cocodona is a runner's course. Like it's a lot of running, tons of it. Every year I'm shocked at how much I'm running. I'm like, this sucks. But like, if you want to do well, you need to run.
Yeah, for sure.
So that's a pretty cool approach. So Moab 240, you're at the start line for the second time. Like obviously you know the course better than you did for the other two. Like what do you like about the Moab course? What were the parts you were looking forward to experiencing again? And what were the sections that maybe you were like, I don't want to do that again?
Yeah. So, like I said, by the time, like I didn't want to do Moab, but by the time I got to the starting line, I was like, okay, I'm pretty excited about this opportunity. I was actually really happy to be back in Moab once we got there, because it's just so beautiful down there. And like, the first time at Moab sucked. Like I didn't even like if you asked me about Moab, I wouldn't tell you about how beautiful the scenery is or how amazing the mountains are or anything like that. I would just tell you how bad my feet hurt, like, you know. And so going into it, I was like, I am in a way better place. I might actually get to like enjoy this a little bit, you know. But I was really like sweating that first section, the like Lockhart Basin section, the first day, essentially big push through the desert. And they moved the start time this year. I don't know if you guys were tracking that, but we started at like 1 p.m., you know, to get the mid to back of the pack, like into that desert, that hot desert section at night. And I think that worked pretty well. I think there was like considerably less drops there than there has been historically. Usually that thing, that like 24 mile section from, it used to be Breaking Bad, but it's Base Camp now, to Oasis, like that like wiped out like half the field usually. but they changed that, and then they made the water stop in there manned or like staffed with people so that they didn't run out of water. And I think that really helped people. But anyway, sorry, that was the section I was dreading. And I actually just like, I was in way better shape and I was a runner it. And I was just like, well, this is fun. I'm having fun just cruising out through the desert, like running all these old Jeep trails, like piece of cake, you know? And that's when I realized I was going to have a fun race. You know, I was like, oh, this is going to be an entirely different experience than it was last year. Like, let's go.
You talked about course changes. One other change is that they added like an additional 4 miles, right? And they made the Shea Mountain section different. What was that like from 2022 to 2023?
Yeah, so they shuffled a little. It was mostly the same course except for the Shea. When you leave Shea Mountain, instead of that being like the high point on that section and you going down, back down into the desert, you climb up to the top of the Abajos. And that section is like amazing, especially if I went through it at night, but I had ran that section like scouting the week before the race, just cause I wanted to go see the new section. I did it during the daytime and it's amazing. It is high. It's the new highest point on the course and it's like a 12-mile section and you go to a new aid station and then you tie back in with the old course. But I hope they keep that section in. It's awesome. It's like just super rad, like, you know, desert mountain, like the mountains in the desert are cool down there. They go up pretty high and like you get up to like 11,000 feet and up in the Aspens in the fall, like there's no better place to be. It's pretty neat. So it did add a lot of extra climbing, but like, you know, I don't think it was that significant. It wasn't that significant of a, it wasn't a factor for me. It was just an added bonus, I think, but I hope they keep it in there. And then the other section they added to was leaving Pole Canyon. So the second time you go up in the mountains, the La Salles, when you're a little bit closer to the finish line, they added like a little detour and the trail was just garbage. It went through like this old burned area. I don't really know what the point of adding that was. Maybe, I guess it was to get the mileage up to 240. Like they realized the course was maybe a little bit short historically, but that section should go. It's not really necessary.
I took care of Peter and made sure he got all the 240 miles when I paced him, right?
Yeah, yeah, that's right. We had a little incident. It was fun though. After Pole Canyon, after whatever the next one was,
Geyser.
We were going down a fire road. There was a spot where we should have turned right onto a single track, but we just kept going down this road. But there was cows with us. We chased a cow 2 miles down a mountain, and then we got the golf cart of shame came and found me.
Oh no! Oh no!
I took him on like a 4 mile detour, but he was the only person in 2022 who had like 240 miles on the dot.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, so yeah. It was for Strava. So, all right. So Tahoe, Bigfoot, Moab. Which one of the three is your personal favorite?
For me, interestingly enough, like Moab is for sure. It's like the course that I've learned the most about myself on. And I just think like, it's a really good place to go. It's really challenging in the way that it's like very extreme. Like you're dealing with like 90 degrees down in the desert one day, and then you're up in the mountains at 11,000 feet and it's like 7 degrees that night. And it's just like, that stuff's really difficult to put your body through and your mind through. But like when you get done with it, you're just like, well, what can I do? You know, that's how that race makes you feel. You know, I think it's just for me growing up in Northern California, I've spent a lot of time in the mountains and the timber, and like being able to enjoy a big experience like that in the desert is definitely my favorite. And I mean, it's a world-class race for sure.
Which one do you think's the best race for a first 200?
For a first 200, I would say Tahoe. Like Tahoe, even though like there's a lot of climbing, it's like, it's basically like, you know, this, you go up and then you have these huge downhills. You're either always like doing a big climb where you're just hiking, or you're like bombing some buttery single track. And I think it's pretty friendly. The sections aren't huge. Like they're pretty manageable sections. There's some shorter ones in there depending on the course. You know, I've only done the like out and back style. I think that is a good starter course for 200 milers for sure.
Yeah, I think I agree. My wife Melanie's doing her first 200 next year at Tahoe.
Nice.
And yeah, I mean, when I did it, it was the full loop around the lake. I've paced the out and back version. My kind of assumption based on not much information is that they're more or less similar in difficulty. You know, I don't think it's like you're missing some good sections without doing the full circumnavigation, but you're also getting to hit other difficult and beautiful sections twice. So right. I do think it's somewhat similar in terms of like the race as a whole and the experience you get.
All right. So, you know, maybe switching gears a bit, can you talk to us a bit about like, what are your future goals in the sport?
Yeah. So my future goals like remains, I love 200 milers. Like when I saw this show, when I saw you guys start to do this show, I got so fired up. Like I was just like, oh my God, like somebody else wants to talk about 200 milers all the time. Awesome. And so like my goal is to just like keep exploring that. I want to get, like I said, there's like a psychological thing for me with this is like, I want to prove to myself that I could do this. And then I did. And now I'm like, okay, well, like I can do decent at these things, but like, it'd be foolish to think that there isn't still a lot of room for improvement. And so like, I want to start winning 200 milers. Like that's my goal, you know, like that's the best I could do in a 200 miler is to get there, get to the finish line first. I have no idea how to do that. I don't know if I can, but I'm going to keep pursuing that, you know, and just trying to get, you know, the most out of myself that I can in that format because I love it so much. But I kind of am going about it in a weird way this year. Like rather than just signing up for 200s, I'm also really intrigued with backyards. I found out that I'm more intrigued with them than I actually like to do them. I don't actually like to do them at all. And hopefully I'll not be doing them. I got to stick with my plan, you know, but I have an obsession with these things. And I was like, well, it's a good way to like practice 200 milers, like multi-day running, probably a faster pace than you would normally in a 200 miler. Like I want to be able to run 200 miles in 48 hours. Backyard's a perfect place to achieve that goal. So I decided I was going to make a run at Big's Backyard and qualify for that. So that's my plan this year. And then I'm also another thing that is purely focused at running, getting better at 200 milers is I'm going to try to run an FKT on the Oregon Coast Trail this summer, which is about 420 miles or something. And it's like, at this point I've ran more 200s than 100s, and 100s is just, I'm like, what? It's like you leave this morning and you get back tomorrow and you're done. Like that sounds fine. And I want the same thing to happen. Like if I go run 400 miles, like I think 200 will feel pretty manageable, you know, it's just kind of like changing that reference point. So getting into some longer stuff and some longer FKTs to circle back around to 200 milers with more experience next year is kind of, that's the goal for this year. So I came up short at my first backyard. So I'm going to run another backyard in April. Definitely like shooting for, you know, 200 plus miles in that one. And then I'm going to run the Oregon 200 this year just because it just dawned on me the other day that it's like 30 miles from my house and I'm not doing anything outside of the FKT, which will probably be a little bit earlier in the summer. So I should be in good shape to go run the Oregon, try to win it.
Awesome. We just had the race directors, Todd and Renee. Last week. That episode will probably be releasing like mid to late March.
Cool.
But Oregon 200 looks beautiful. And yeah, I mean, just a runnable, beautiful course. So that'll be cool to follow you there. And yeah, I mean, I share the same, you know, my opinions haven't changed since we met at Seguro Showdown at the Backyard Ultra there, where, you know, I went 25 laps. I think you went 37.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. So 100 plus miles and 150 plus miles respectively. And I just didn't like the format, but but that like massive respect, like to the really the any, like all the people who went 150 to, you know, 170, 260, 270, like unbelievable. And like, wish I liked it more so that I could explore that version of me that could maybe push that far, but I just didn't love the format. So it'll be cool to see you give it another go in April. Were there any, like, what were your biggest takeaways from Seguro that you're going to go into? Is it Banana Slug? Is that the next one?
Banana Slug. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. So it was like, I mean, we talked about it. We both just openly admitted each other during that race. Like, this sucks. This is stupid. Why are we? There's so many better ways to run than this.
Dude, you know what killed me? Coldwater Rumble was happening.
I know, right?
Like there was a cool 100 miler like 30 minutes away.
Yeah, like on the other side of the mountain.
Yeah. If I'm going to spend my body's tax and like use my, like I want a, you know, a buckle and a cool race. But anyway.
Yeah. No, that's how you feel when you're doing those things. So when I got done with it, I was like, I don't even I was done. I had set that goal aside. I was like, I don't even care about Bigs. I don't even think I'm going to run Banana Slug. Like, I think I'm done with backyards. And then I was like, okay, well, I don't think I can let myself off the hook that easily. And what I realized, my takeaway from it, to answer your question, is that like, I need a different approach to it. Like, trying to win a backyard is not a good place, a good mindset to like be in, because you're like, you actually, by default, you're like, wanting the people you're running with to fail. And like, I don't know. That just doesn't work for me. Like, that mindset doesn't work for me. So going into Banana Slug, I was like, I'm going to try this with a completely different mindset of just like setting a personal goal and just like making it my race and not about being the last person standing or any of that crap. It's just like, I'm going to go try to do something and test myself. And I actually need, in a backyard, I need the other people to keep running for me to do that. And so it's just kind of like changing the psychology of it. And so I'm hoping that I can have a better time with it than we had and I've had in backyards previously. We'll see if it works. I don't know.
I like that. It's almost like they're not competition. They're teammates, right? Like,
exactly.
It's like,
yeah.
Like you know, you're all in it together. And it wasn't all bad. I mean, we had some pretty good jams in the middle of the night. We were rocking for a little while.
Thanks to you.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, one thing that I found like interesting with the backyard format is how like, and it's just so not who, I shouldn't say it's so not who I am, because I probably have done it before, but like everyone is trying to hide if they're struggling. And I'm always like, you know, I'll be the first one to tell you how shitty I'm feeling. Like, I'm still going to try to go beat you. But like, you know, like in a 200, I'm like, I roll into an aid station and like, I think I look worse than anyone else.
Uh-huh.
That doesn't mean I won't catch you down the way. But like, I found the sort of the cat and mouse style very interesting. And I don't think I loved it.
Yeah.
Again, maybe that's a little hypocritical, but I didn't love it.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, no, it is a weird, it's a weird thing. Like my crew, my dude, Thomas, who was crewing me, like he had no idea that I was about to quit when I did. And I like, I mean, I don't really want to share the whole story, but like I crapped my pants like twice on the last two loops. Like I got to that point and I was like, I can't figure out how to manage all these things anymore. Like I can't do 4 miles and eat food and poop my pants and clean myself up. And like, I just couldn't fit all that into 1 hour.
Yeah.
But
I guess what happens in backyard stays in backyard.
Yeah, sure.
Mostly.
Should have. Yeah, but it's spilled the beans. But yeah, Thomas like didn't know because I was playing that game too. I was playing poker. Like I didn't want to show him my weakness because I wanted him to like be confident in what I was doing. And yeah, you're right. It's like, it's a weird, I don't know. There's just like so many more natural ways to go about these things than that format, you know? But I think it can be beautiful too with a different mindset, like the teammate thing where like, I have this big goal that I want to achieve and I need these people's help to do that. I think that's going to be a fun way to explore it.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to following, I guess, in like 6 weeks.
Coming up.
Yeah, that'll be fun to see how that, because it's, I mean, it sounds so simple, right? Like that mindset shift and it's like, yeah, that makes total sense. Like, okay, but how do we put that into play? So we'll be watching and pulling for you.
Sweet.
So you just, talk to us about your athletic goals. Maybe the flip side of that, professionally, can you tell us a bit about what Huda Trail is, what the vision behind it is, and what that's all about?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, so like Huda Trail was born through like my experience at Moab. We talked about how it's like a really challenging race with extreme conditions. And I remember like walking through dry valley desert with like a puffy jacket strapped on my back. And I was just like, what am I doing? Like, I don't know what I'm doing. And I just like, I was on this, and then I was really cold at night and like just body temperature and like moisture management in these multi-day things. It's like a tough nut to crack. And I went on this quest to like find better gear. And so post Moab, I started like doing some research on the internet and I found out about all these people who were just like mostly backpackers, like the hiking crowd that were like, yeah, playing with all these other different types of fabric and building their own stuff. And like they had sewing machines and they were just like going for it, making gear in their living room. And I was like, wait, what is all this? And I started to learn about it and I learned about this fabric. It's mostly what I focus on, Alpha Direct. It's like an active insulation fabric that manages moisture really well. And so it works out really good for trail running. It works out really good for multi-day stuff. Day to night transitions. I could go on and on about the qualities of this fabric and how awesome it is for ultra running, but I won't do that. But when I got into I found out about cottage industry, like all these people across the world that are just making gear custom for other people on small scales. And I was like, I don't think the ultra community really knows that there's this resource out there. Like there's much more selection in gear than like REI or like, you know, even like the bigger brands, even like the small independent brands within the, and there's like, there's a lot more to that. And I don't think a lot of people know they can go on Instagram and buy like a super special technical piece of gear for running 200 miles from $90 from some guy that'll sew it in his bedroom and ship it to him next week. Like most people running 200 milers don't even know that exists. I didn't, when I found out about it, I was like, this is rad. I got to get like, this is a way for me to serve my community that's given me so much and like been there for me. Like, I mean, that's why I love 200 milers. One of the reasons is like all the people you meet, like you guys, and just the experiences we have out there and how we take care of each other and stuff. And so it was a no brainer for me. I was like, I'm going to dive into this. It was a side hustle for a long time. And I started making these clothes for people, and now I do it full time. And, you know, my goal is to just like get the word out, not necessarily about my company, just, but about what Cottage Gear is and the fact that there's like, there's a really cool option for people to get gear, different kinds of gear. You know, you can get packs, fast packing packs, custom made for you, you know, all kinds of stuff. And so, yeah, that's my vision is to like see this stuff at the start line of 200 milers. And then my second vision, I also like to have fun with all this. And so I'm making all these like fun, like Hawaiian print sun shirts and stuff. I call them fun shirts. And my second goal is to get like as many fun shirts on the starting line of Cocodona this year as possible. So you guys can just throw that out there to the folks, to the listeners.
I'll wear a fun shirt at the start of Cocodona. Last year I wore a French fry print shorts.
Oh, nice.
So, you know, we can definitely get creative and get some Huda Trail out there on the start line.
There you go. Yeah.
I can't guarantee it'll make it more than a half mile because I overheat like nobody else, but totally. I'll start with it.
I'll make sure it's new ones too.
Yeah, there you go. No, that's really cool. And like, you know, Peter, you sent Peter and I a couple, and we'll get into it kind of, you know, post show here and do our review. But, you know, my initial impression was like, I was shocked at how light it was, like just taking the package out of the mailbox.
Yeah.
And I've done a bit of fast packing. So like kind of knew this sort of thing existed on like a little bit of a bigger scale with like Z Packs and like Six Moon Designs and like those sorts of like, you know, sort of smaller brands. And that's what it reminds me of, like really high quality, really lightweight. And yeah, like I said, we'll dive into that more. Can you, you know, if people are curious as to what the hell we're talking about, where can they find more, and what does like the process of like getting one look like?
Yeah. So the cool thing specifically for like the Alpha Direct stuff and, a lot of like the packs, like you're talking about and stuff, come check me out on Instagram at Huda Trail. I run my entire business through Instagram, and it's just Huda Trail, Houda Trail, two words. That's where I do my business. I got pictures posted. I got some resources where you can kind of learn about what it is, and then just send me a message, and I'll tell you all about it. And it's just me. I'm pretty limited. I can only do so many orders a week. So like, this is not about generating business for me. Like I can't really handle, you know, like more. I don't plan on growing this beyond my capability to sit in my room and sew all day, but there's a bunch of other companies. And I can definitely turn people onto those that are doing similar things, or, you know, just making custom gear for people. Like you can get custom gaiters made. I make a really cool thing. I make is like a waistband holders for Kogala lamps, stuff like that. You know, it's like all the stuff you could dream up, somebody with the sewing machine can just make for you. Yeah, to answer your question, Huda Trail at Instagram, come say hi and I'll get you dialed in. Did I answer the question? I think that was the question.
Yeah, okay. Definitely. All right, let's wrap it up with our normal quick five questions, which you are somewhat familiar with if you've listened to these. Let's answer for the Triple Crown. So only using Tahoe, Bigfoot, and Moab.
Okay.
From 2023. All right. All right, so highest high during the Triple Crown.
Definitely racing Sally McRae down a 9,000 foot mountain at sunrise to end the Tahoe 200 for sure.
And I forget if you mentioned, who came out first in that between the two of you?
She didn't pass me, but she was right back there. I never saw her, but I was afraid. I came out victorious. I passed her and Elsa and didn't let anybody pass me. I was on a sick one. I was like, whoa.
Lowest low in a Triple Crown.
Definitely. So during Moab this year, during the Triple Crown. At about mile 85, I started having some like pretty wild Achilles pain, like running on the flats. It was right after like a super high moment where I had a miracle morning when the sun came up, leaving Indian Creek. But my Achilles started bothering me and it was getting worse and worse and worse. And I probably had about 30 minutes of just like, you kind of start to lose your ability to like be reasonable about this stuff. And you're like, well, my race is over. And that means my Triple Crown's over. And I'm not even going to finish the Triple Crown. And you know, you just, I like death spiraled with fear and like all that for about 20 minutes. And it was really tough. It was really hard. And finally I just accepted that I wasn't going to be able to move the way I wanted to. Still like moved fine, got fifth overall, like no big deal. But in those initial moments of that, like sprouting up, it's pretty hard to deal with.
It always blows my mind how something that seems so like race, potential race ending or so impactful, like could be a non-issue or not nearly the issue you imagine it like down the road. It's just, it's so hard not to like doom spiral when something like that happens. And it's like, I think it's Jason Kubu who says it doesn't always get worse or something like that. And like
never, you know, always just, gets worse.
It never always gets worse. And that's like, it's so like common sense says, well, I'm doing the same thing. Yeah. I'm not removing any variables. Of course it's going to get worse, but that's just not how it works.
Totally. And I think that's like probably the most valuable skill to have in a 200 miler is to like, when you're presented with those, when those things pop up, because they will, is like being able to keep that like, okay, just keep moving and figure this out and get to the aid station, get to crew, and we'll problem solve this. I don't need to go there with this right now. Like, and that's what I eventually did. Eventually I was like, okay, well, like it doesn't matter. Maybe I don't even finish this race. It doesn't matter. What matters is that I'm walking up a 2-track road out in the desert right now. And that's what I need to be doing. So who cares about like all the other stuff, you know?
Yeah. All right. Next one is, what was your favorite food from the destination trail aid stations?
Oh, pizza at the end. So my favorite 200 mile food is pizza for sure. Like I had the best pizza of my life in the middle of Bigfoot. It wasn't destination trail, but I love getting to the end of those races where they got the little dude cooking the pizzas in the little pizza oven. And I try to like con him into giving me more than one. I maybe get two or three. I don't want to get the guy in trouble with Garrett and Cam.
I've always gotten two.
Yeah. That's like, those are the best pizzas ever. You're sitting there with a belt buckle and a pizza. Like, yeah, that's it for sure. Pizza. I'll take all the pizza I can get in a 200 miler.
All right. Favorite piece of gear you used in the Triple Crown?
For sure this year, the Alpha Direct 90 gram pullover is just like such a game changer for multi-day stuff. And that's, it weighs like 3 ounces and it fits, it like packs up into nothing and it goes in your pack and it will just like save your ass. Definitely. That and a Kogala.
All right. Last question. We know the answer to it. You know the answer to it, but it's how we end all our episodes. Jameson, have you found your distance to empty yet?
Not even close, man.
All right. Keep looking for it. Thanks for being on, man. That was fun.
Sweet. Thanks, guys. That was fun.
Well, that was a super fun chat. I think it's pretty cool to see someone like Jameson go from like, you know, maybe struggling with alcohol dependency into kind of finding himself, not sure what his like self-worth and like capability is, to just like absolutely shattering like human performance and potential goals. It's a pretty wild roller coaster he's been on.
Yeah, I agree. He's a really interesting person. Excited to see how he does in the Triple Crown. Sounds like he's doing it again.
Yeah, I guess he liked it enough to dive back in. So, you know, I think experience means a lot in these races and these events. So it'll be cool to see him go after it again and see what he can do differently. But those hoodies that he makes and the custom clothing that he makes. So, I mean, full disclosure, he sent Peter and I one of his Alpha Direct hoodies to review and to kind of share our thoughts on. So we got those in the mail and I've taken mine out on a couple of runs, and like, it really is like a lighter weight Melanzana. If you're familiar with those like Melanzanas from Colorado, it's just a really cool like micro grid piece that's like very breathable, super lightweight. I think it's under 3 ounces. I was shocked at how light it was. And what I really loved about it is like, I get so warm that like, I often find myself getting down to a t-shirt, even in like the high 30s and 40s in Colorado. And I've been able to wear this and be comfortable in temperatures like ranging from mid-30s to mid-50s, just because it's that lightweight and it really does kind of just work well in multiple environments and conditions. So I'm a big fan. I actually placed an order for another one for Cocodona, one of his fun shirts. So I went from being a promo recipient, getting it for free, to actually buying one. So, I mean, I guess that means I liked it.
Yeah, I think it's a great article of clothing. You know, for 200, something I've worn for many of them has been a Patagonia wool underlayer. And I think this could really be a better version of that, especially it has a hood and it is lighter weight. And yeah, one problem with the Patagonia wool one is that, as you said, as it gets warmer, you just need that thing off, right? So I think this is less clothing changes you'll need, which saves time and is much more comfortable. So yeah, I love it.
Yeah, and they make, you know, they're custom, they're fit to you, they're cool, fun designs. So if you're curious and want to know what the heck we're talking about, check out Jameson's Instagram at Huda Trail, HoudaTrail. And all the details about what he does and how to find out more information are on Instagram. And he's super accessible if you shoot him a message. So check that out.
All right. So let's get into some categories. I'll start. So performance of the week. So this week we found our performance of the week on Instagram. One of our followers, we presume his name's Tyler. Handle is CrimsonTyler88. And just completed the Mississippi Trail 100, which looks to be his first 100. So that's very exciting. And just from scrolling through the pictures, it looks like it was quite the first 100. A lot of rain. There's pictures of like thigh deep trail, I guess, water crossings, or maybe that even that was the trail. But anyway, big shout out. 100's always a big accomplishment, your first one. And hope to see you out there in some 200s. So kudos to Tyler.
Yeah, nice work, Tyler. That one picture was like almost waist deep, like muddy water. That was crazy looking. All right, let's chat about these snacks we got today. I really did not like this one. So Peter and I do a snack review. We ordered a kind of a mystery bag from Galactic Snacks, and we have been trying these exotic snacks from all over the world on the podcast. What do we have today, Peter?
So today, I don't really know exactly what it is. It's definitely Cheetos. The graphics on the front of this bag are a lot of fire. It looks like some sort of skewer with vegetables and meat on it. That's really all we know about it. And it's from Thailand. So I don't know. The smell of it was interesting, almost like a little fishy. But I don't see any fish in the picture, and it's pretty spicy. So probably would not work in a 200.
Yeah, I don't think I'll finish the bag here, let alone use them in a race. They it was a little off-putting for me, but yeah. And worth noting too that the language on it is Thai, and the Google Translate camera has been doing pretty good on these snack items to like tell us what they are a little bit, and it did not know what to say about this. Like it changed words and they didn't make any sense. Like It was mostly nonsense. So we really have no idea what is in these things or what they taste like.
Yeah. I mean, I think I could power through the bag, but I would never race with this.
Yeah. Let us know what the kids think of it.
Will do.
All right. It is time for my favorite part of the podcast. Let's Get Deep. Peter and I play Let's Get Deep, which is a card game for couples. So we are going to read each other the cards and answer the questions. There are three categories, icebreaker, deep, and deeper. I'll kick it off, Peter, and give you your icebreaker. What was your most memorable birthday gift or surprise?
Good question. I can't really remember a really memorable birthday, but I think the biggest, I'll just shift it. The biggest surprise I've ever gotten was I was dating my wife long distance. I graduated from college and I had no idea. But she showed up as a surprise and was there for my college graduation. And a lot of people were in on the surprise without me. So that was awesome.
That's pretty fun. I'll do that one day. I'll show up at your house without you knowing.
Can't wait. All right. Icebreaker for you. So a DIY home repair, or are you hiring a professional?
Oh, definitely hiring a professional if I can afford it. I am not a DIY or, not very good at that sort of stuff. We actually have we're getting new doors put in next week. So we have a project beginning that we hired professionals to do. So definitely professionals if I can swing it. Okay, deep for you. What role do you play in your family?
So in my family, I am definitely, I'd say the more serious one at times. I ground the family sometimes, I think. Like, sometimes I'm the one that has to say no when there's too many crazy ideas. But at the same time, I love being spontaneous and doing the unexpected. So I think it's a pretty even balance overall. Okay, deep for you. If you had a chance to ask the government one thing, what would you want to know?
Huh. I mean, all that alien talk a few months ago was pretty cool. Maybe I'd just be like, so, like, let's hear the truth on that. Have we made contact? Do we know that there's life out there? Yeah, I'd find out about that. And then I'd tell other people.
Yeah, I'd like to know that too. The truth is out there.
That's right. All right, deeper. What is a risk you took in the past and what happened?
So I'd say the biggest risk I have ever taken in my life is that I had just graduated from high school and just a friend's dad offered me a job as an intern at this company. I had no idea what it was or anything about it. And he gave me his number on just a piece of paper. And I took a risk as a 17-year-old. I called that number, got a job. And actually 24 years later, I'm actually still working basically as part of that trajectory. We've now spun out a couple companies since, but I'm still on that same path. So that's the biggest risk I've ever taken and paid off for sure.
I can't believe you made a phone call.
I know, it was really hard. I was better at phone calls back then before there were other options. All right, deeper for you. What's something you'll never try again and why?
A backyard ultra. I hated that thing. It's funny because I think I'm actually doing another one in late March, but it's like a friend organizing it for like a fun training day with friends. So I'll do that, but I don't think I'll ever do another official backyard ultra. I hated that thing.
Will you try anything different to change it up?
Yeah. I mean, I won't go 25 loops. I'll go like 10.
Okay. You want to try to be the fastest each loop or anything, or no?
No, I don't think so. Yeah, I like to walk and you know, only have a few minutes to snack and get back out there. But yeah, staying far away from the official backyard ultras for now. Awesome. Well, thank you for listening. Please don't forget to give us a review. Subscribe wherever you're listening right now. It takes 2 seconds, and it really helps us grow the show. We really appreciate it. We'll catch you next time.